Wisconsin is now one of just six states with one Republican and one Democratic U.S. Senator. It wasn't always that way. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer Kent. But when you look at the polling and we follow the trends, partisanship is a stronger factor in state elections, and Wisconsin has been and remains a very split state. So let me ask you first, what role do you see partisanship playing in our state's elections? And do you avoid the pollsters? Are you a skeptic of polling? Because our guest this morning, I'll give you the phone number, 1-800-642-1234 to join our conversation. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. Our guest is Charles Franklin. He's the professor of law and public policy at Marquette University and the director of the Marquette Law School Poll. Charles, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good to be here. Happy to talk to you again.
Yeah, you had a Twitter post a couple weeks ago at Polls and Votes. It's your Twitter handle about how few U.S. Senate, how few states split their U.S. Senate delegates. It's six, but it wasn't always that way. Can you give us some perspective on what we're seeing here, Charles?
Yeah, there's been quite a change in this over the years. 40 years ago, so 1980, 81. Half of the states, 25 states, had split Senate delegations, one Republican and one Democrat. Then 30 years ago, it was 21 states. 20 years ago, it was 14. 10 years ago, it was still 17. And 2 years ago, 9. Today, there are just 6, with Wisconsin one of those, along with Pennsylvania, Ohio, Montana, West Virginia and Maine are the six. That's an incredible change over a 40-year period that really reflects the changing nature of state elections, in which partisanship plays a bigger role and you're just like less likely to see two candidates from different parties be able to construct consistent majorities from the states. And I should give credit where credit's due. Craig Gilbert at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel wrote a very nice piece on this a couple of weeks ago. And I'm stealing his numbers about how many delegations were split over time.
It is an interesting story, but as the director of the Marquette Law School poll, you chimed in on these numbers about what they mean. And that really goes to the heart of it in Wisconsin as one of just six states with a split U.S. Senate delegation and a U.S. Senate race in the midterms next year for Republican Senator Ron Johnson's seat. So what does it mean for the political odd couple in the Senate of Senator Tammy Baldwin and Ron Johnson?
I think there are a couple of ways you can look at it. One would be from the sort of big perspective. When you have split delegations historically, or 20 years ago, 40 years ago, you often saw those two senators work together on things for their state. They might disagree on a lot of things, but when it came to projects, for the state, even things like selecting judicial nominees from the state, we often saw cooperation between those senators on those things. Today, the splits are more deeply ideological and the cooperation is less, because you don't only have to go across a partisan divide, you also have to cross a big ideological divide. There's a standard measure used in political science based on roll call votes that the senators cast, and it goes from minus one to plus one, from liberal to conservative. And what we see now is that four of those six split delegations have pretty polarized senators ideologically. They're well apart on this, and in Wisconsin, Baldwin and Johnson are actually the biggest ideological gap between senators, though Pennsylvania is not far behind. What that means is you have much less ability to see agreement on things like judicial nominations or on things that tap ideological concerns. So you might think of things like aid to farmers as something that historically both senators would work hard on. But as farm aid became a partisan issue and an ideological issue over the last 5 years, as we've had, trade tariffs and embargoes, makes it harder for those ideologically different senators to cooperate on legislation.
So for the people in the states where the lion's share have either both Democrats or both Republicans in the U.S. Senate, do they have more political power than the six who split?
Well, I think they have more unified power, at least in principle. Now, some of these folks may be ideologically close and hate each other. You know, let's not diminish that possibility. But at least they don't have to overcome the ideological barriers. When you see two senators of the same party from the same state, they are generally pretty close together. They may both be pretty liberal Democrats or both be pretty conservative Republicans, but they're not that far apart from one another. Whereas in these odd couple split delegations, we see differences between the two senators of anywhere from four times bigger than when they're the same party to as much as literally 10 times bigger. So there can be quite a big ideological gap when we cross parties, and that gap is on average a lot smaller when you look at senators from within the same party. I've made this all sound like a negative. Let's recognize the more positive part of it, and that means that you have a senator that Democrats within the state can identify with and one that Republicans in the state can identify with, and so neither side feels completely shut out of representation if both senators were from the opposite party, from the party that you're not part of. And it does mean that within negotiations within the parties in Congress, or in the Senate at least, the state has a representative in those caucuses, whether it's the Democratic caucus or the Republican caucus. So at least theoretically, there's an upside that way.
Our guest is Charles Franklin. He's the co-founder of Pollster.com and founder of PollsandVotes.com and the director of the Marquette Law School Poll. So what questions do you have about polling and how they predict elections? What races are you paying attention to in the next year's midterm elections? 1-800-642-1234 to join us this morning. And Charles, we've heard you say before on this show that polling isn't necessarily the best way to gauge or predict the outcome of elections, but it is a great way to gauge the trend lines of where we stand, and that in some way can infer what the elections, the outcome of the elections may be. But we are on the precipice of next year's midterm elections. We do have a U.S. senator up for re-election next year, but he has not announced whether or not he's going to run. You talked about ideological versus partisanship. One of the issues that the Republican Party is dealing with is, and we've seen this recently with candidate J.D. Vance, the author of Hillbilly Elegy, how close to side themselves with President Trump. And I would ask you, because Senator Johnson, if he decides to run for re-election, what role does the continuation of the Trump platform have to do with the Republican Party and the midterms next year?
Yeah, I think that's going to be a very interesting thing to watch and how it develops over time. Right now, President Trump continues to play a big role, rhetorically at least, within the Republican Party, with the former president speaking out on candidates. He's said he would like Senator Johnson to seek re-election, sometimes endorsing candidates explicitly in primaries, which within the Republican Party can be a big endorsement. And you've seen candidates or potential candidates usually embrace President Trump. As we've seen, you mentioned J.D. Vance in Ohio, just this week has released some statements saying that, yes, he opposed Trump in 2015 and 16, but he's seen the light and come around and now believes that Trump was a positive force in the party.
Also, according to NBC News, it's Senator James Lankford out of Oklahoma, who Oklahoma Republican chairman has endorsed a primary opponent for him, the incumbent senator, Republican senator from Oklahoma, because of his criticisms of the president.
And this is exactly the dilemma within the party. We can cite a lot of examples, including President Trump's statement condemning Speaker Robin Voss for not pursuing a state vote audit.
The entire Republican state legislative leadership.
Well, that's right. All three leaders were named and, yeah. and were called on to be
on the weekend of the state Republican. Yeah, on the weekend of the state Republican convention. That's right. How the state Wisconsin Republican convention started this year. So, what does that mean for the midterms next year? That's where our guest is taking us next. Charles Franklin is professor of law and public policy at Marquette University, director of the Marquette Law School poll, and understandably, you may have some questions for him. Some are skeptical about polling and the science behind it. That's why we ask you to join us and find out more with our guest, Charles Franklin, next at 1-800-642-1234. I'm Lee Rayburn. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. So how often does the president actually gain legislative seats and power in a midterm election? It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and our guest is the guy who pulls out the data to get us the answer. In the U.S. Senate, the president's political party has picked up seats six times since 1960. In the House of Representatives, most recently, President Clinton gained seats in 98, and President Bush gained seats in 2002. Now, what does all this mean for the 2022 midterm elections? And what do you think Congress will look like in 2023? And what that might that mean for Wisconsin and you and me? And take your calls this morning at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email ideas at WPR.org. Our guest is Charles Franklin, professor of law and public policy at Marquette University and the director of the Marquette Law School poll. And Charles, as you've pointed out, it's not common for the president to pick up seats in a midterm election, but it certainly has happened in the past.
It has, but in the Senate, it has happened relatively often. Most of the time, the president's party loses, but he does sometimes gain seats. Whereas in the House, it's only the two times you mentioned, 98 and 02, and 1934 in the depths of the recession. Otherwise, it's been almost never. 1902, the president's party gained some seats, but that was also a year that the size of the House expanded, so they actually lost in the percentage of seats they held. And those are the only four examples since 1860. And so this is why it is such a strong expectation that seats are lost in the midterms. Though we have this recent 98 and 02 examples, both of which were a little special, but it does raise the question. Sometimes the losses are greater and sometimes they're smaller. And that, of course, is where things could matter at the margin this time.
Sure. And when we roll back the clock to last year's elections, we saw a record turnout. But does that hold true for midterm elections in 2022, Charles?
Almost always, in fact, always, the midterm turnout is quite a bit less than the previous presidential turnout. You can have higher turnout midterms. We saw that in 2018 here. But they're not higher than the presidential. They're just higher than the average midterm. And both parties in 2020 successfully mobilized a lot of new voters. So a big question is, which party will retain more of those voters in the midterm? And that's really up in the air. Historically, Democrats have seen bigger losses, bigger drop-off in turnout among their voting base, and Republicans relatively less. But the Republican Party in the last few years has gained a lot of voters who are what we call low-propensity voters. They're people who turn out in a big presidential election, but they're generally not high turnout voters. The GOP badly needs to convert those new voters into regular voters instead of low propensity voters, while the Democrats need to mobilize their supporters. And ironically, on both sides, without Donald Trump on the ballot, both sides lose one of their best mobilizing elements, Democrats to target Trump, Republicans to rally around him. And so it's going to be a very interesting question of how that plays out on turnout.
And that doesn't that go to the heart of how difficult polling can be at predicting election outcomes, that's not necessarily what polling is there for, that the trend lines are more about where we're going as opposed to what the outcome will be tomorrow?
That's right. The trend lines, I would always say, pay attention to those more than other things. But the other element of polling is to talk about policy questions. What do we want out of government? What are the issues that concern us? Would we rather have a tax cut or rather have more spending on favorite programs? Those are also things that polling does. And where polling, interestingly, has had a pretty good record predicting public policy preferences and how those turn out in things like statewide referenda, for example. And so, you know, at this point, this far out, we don't even want to poll on the horse race question,
right,
of who's going to run against whom and how well they'll do. The other thing that you mentioned is turnout is an important factor. All election polls really have two elements. One is the likely voter model. How do you identify the people that will vote? And the other is the choice model. Who do you prefer if you vote? And both of those are important. And I think the last few elections have shown that the turnout model is really important, especially when we have a party mobilizing people who in the past were less likely to vote, but have now been recruited by that party or candidate to turn out.
Charles Franklin is a professor of law and public policy at Marquette University and the director of the Marquette Law School Poll. If you have questions about polling or where we're heading, 1-800-642-1234. Where Rhonda's standing by from Madison. Rhonda, good morning. You're on with Charles Franklin.
Hi. My question relates to how polling is now being affected by spam technology concerning me personally. I don't answer a phone call unless I know the phone number. I don't respond to emails, even if they look like they're from a party I would want to have my voice, because I don't trust who wants my information. So you'll never hear my voice in a poll. How is that impacting the quality of polling going forward? And I'll take the answer off the air. Thank you.
Rhonda, thank you for your question. Charles?
Yeah, this is one of the problems with polling. Thanks to caller ID, most calls don't get answered. Now, what does happen is if we call back three or four times over 4 or 5 days, we actually get quite a few people that do pick up on the third or fourth call. So it is possible to get through to people, but it's much harder than it used to be. What has been the case is that those who screen their calls are not more likely to be Republican or Democrat, and so it hasn't affected the partisan balance very much in the surveys. The bigger issue for me is when we do get someone on the line is it looks like over the last two presidential elections that President Trump supporters were a little bit less willing to do the survey, about 3 or 4% less likely to do the survey than Democrats were. As a result, we were very close on the Democratic votes for Clinton and for Biden, but we were consistently 3 or 4 points too low on Trump. And so that has been the big problem, that response is not simply getting through to you on the phone, but a differential non-response. And, you know, not to overstate it, it's a few percentage points, but those matter in close presidential elections like we've been having. Interestingly, in 2018, with President Trump not on the ballot, the polls were much more accurate. Here in the state, we had the governor's race as a one-point margin, and we missed it by 1 point, and we missed the Senate race by just a tenth of a point. So that's the other issue going forward. Is this effect of Trump supporters being less willing to do interviews particular to him being on the ballot, and it'll go away in the midterm? Or is it something that's being ingrained more deeply with voters, in which case we have a continuing problem?
Charles Franklin, talking about pollster avoidance, we got about a minute left, but I also, from the other perspective, want to know what sort of impact new voting regulations across the country might have on tying polling outcomes to election outcomes. Is that going to create a challenge for you?
Well, it's certainly something that we're going to worry a lot about. It goes in part to that ability of a voter who says they're going to vote to actually translate that into having a ballot counted on election day. You know, this is a moving target as different states have implemented different policies. Sort of reflects back on the development of photo ID, for example. Though most political science studies of photo ID requirements find very small or non-existent effects in terms of total turnout, though sometimes they see bigger effects with certain subgroups who are more affected, like people that don't have a car or don't have a driver's license. So there are issues there that we worry about.
Charles Franklin, thank you as always for joining us this morning.
Always a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Charles Franklin is professor of law and public policy at Marquette University and the director of the Marquette Law School Poll. He's also the co-founder of Pollster.com and founder of PollsandVotes.com. Up next is news and our Wisconsin life for the week. Then we get an update on elder abuse in Wisconsin. It is real and is undercounted, and we're going to do something about it with two members of the State Bureau of Aging and Disability Resources. So stay with us. News is next. I'm Lee Rayburn. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network. For Wisconsin Life on The Morning Show, you're listening to the Ideas Network. And this year marks the program's 10th anniversary on WPR. As part of the celebration, here's Wisconsin Life's host, Maureen McCollum, sharing a story from a couple years back about a Milwaukee garden. And here's a voice you know, Peter Bryant, the program director for the NPR News and Music Network, with his favorite Wisconsin Life story.
There's a garden on the north side of Milwaukee where young farmers are learning to grow their own fruits, vegetables, and herbs. But it doesn't stop there. These budding entrepreneurs are also selling their produce.
Hey, young farmers, over here for a second.
I got a strawberry.
I want us to go through the garden, identify what's ready to get harvested. Other than that, we're going to do some business as usual. We need to do some weeding, some watering. I do have some seeds.
I am Alexander Hagler. I'm with Groundwork Milwaukee as a young farmer's program leader.
And I'm Nick DeMarsh, also with Groundwork Milwaukee.
Right now we're at Sherman Park Garden. And this garden started 2 years ago under the hospice of Nick. It's definitely to get young people involved in our food system and just kind of like training them to be agents of change in their own communities.
I got you. I'll take you on the tour. This is our bed where our tomatoes, huh? And this is collard greens, I think. Amir Washington. I'm 12 years old and I'm going to 7th grade. First thing we're going to work on is pulling the weeds out.
Yeah, pulling the weeds out. My name is Anija Howard. I'm 12 years old. The first thing that we actually come for is the strawberries. Like, especially when they're little because they're like, nice and sweet.
I like to grow the strawberries because they're good and the jalapenos.
My mom has a mini farm. Like potatoes, some peppers, and tomatoes.
My name is Cozine, but they call me Coco. Batty. I'm going to the 8th grade.
I'm finna water the plants.
You want to go refill?
Mm-hmm.
You know what? Come on.
I like to plant. I like to give back, like grow them and then give it to homeless people and stuff.
Oh, this is getting heavy.
We're really trying to get them to adopt healthy habits early on in life. So thinking about where their food comes from, the act of gardening as a physical activity, trying to get them to be physically active early on so that they can have these skills for their whole lives.
So what do you guys see that's ready?
These right here, these things, each
one of those. Strawberries
yet. Yep, what do you call those?
The radishes.
That's right.
Twist and then pull.
And the other thing would just be simply being comfortable in the garden, so not freaking out about bugs.
This our sunflower seed. We built this so it can attract bees. I don't know where they went, but once they pollinate, it make our flowers better. So we try to put more flowers in there instead of putting like more lettuce.
What I like most, I like watering the plants because I like seeing them grow more. And it helps me realize how much farmers do for us.
Yep.
Michaela Corman, 13 years old.
We did let folks know that the farm stand is open, so if folks come, we can open that up. In fact, you already see we got a chalkboard. So we're going to put farm stand. I want us to go
to it says farm stand. We have basil, lettuce, radishes, collard greens, beets, chocolate mint, green tomatoes.
Plus,
low prices.
It should be like under $4. Keep it cheap.
We're actually, I was going to ask them about what you guys think of the pay what you can. You know, some people, it's like whatever you have in your pocket. Some people might have a couple bucks, and they'll just give you that.
You got your first customer right here.
You got a customer.
Okay. Which one?
What do you guys have? I heard you have some tomatoes.
Everything's under $4.
Everything's under $4.
So how many sticks of chocolate mint?
I think I'll take three or four. Oh, wow, that's beautiful. I'll definitely buy that one.
So the tomatoes are two, and chocolate mint is like $2.
I like to think that I'm just planting little bugs in their ear, little seeds, and that, you know, as they grow older, they'll start to better understand these things.
Those were some of the young farmers and staff of Groundwork Milwaukee, which operates a handful of educational gardens throughout the Milwaukee area. Curious how you can find their produce?
Next Thursday, you should come at Mary Ryan Boys and Girls Club of Greater Milwaukee and support our farm stand.
And they're under $4.
Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now let's get to work. Elder abuse in Wisconsin. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, in for Kate Archer-Kent. And while state figures show thousands of elder abuse or neglect cases last year, the underreporting of elder abuse means that the numbers we do have are missing people. People we love and people who have been hurt. So what can we do to protect our parents, our grandparents, and ourselves? Your experiences with elder care, good or bad, would be a valuable thing here this morning, and I'd invite you to join us with your stories at 1-800-642-1234. You can always email us ideas at WPR.org, and we're on Twitter at WPR Mornings. Doreen Gatch is the Adult Protective Services Coordinator for the Wisconsin Bureau of Aging and Disability Resources. Doreen, good morning and welcome, and thank you for joining us this morning.
Oh, happy to be here.
Also joining us from the Wisconsin Bureau of Aging and Disability Resources, their Adult Protective Services and Systems Developer, Alice Page. Alice, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
I appreciate your work, and I'm grateful that you are here. And let us begin with setting the scene. Alice, would you tell us, describe for us what elder abuse is? Where does it occur? How do you describe what this large, sometimes unseen, abuse can be?
Well, in Wisconsin, we have statutory definitions of what constitutes abuse. We have physical, emotional, and sexual abuse, along with financial exploitation, neglect, and self-neglect. And as we all know, abuse can happen to anybody. It affects men and women of all ages, across all races, cultures, religions, and socioeconomic groups. Most occurs in the community, but abuse also occurs in long-term care facilities.
Elder abuse does not discriminate, Alice?
Absolutely.
Yeah, and Doreen Gatch, do we have a handle on how prevalent the problem of elder abuse is in Wisconsin?
Oh, we certainly do. Since our department has kept statistics, the reports of alleged abuse have increased every year. For instance, in 2020, APS units across the state received over 10,000 reports of alleged abuse and neglect in Wisconsin.
Over 10,000?
Correct.
And I'd mentioned before, and you'd mentioned that these numbers go up every year. Is this because, as you see it, Doreen, an increase in elder abuse or an increase in reporting and identifying and reporting elder abuse?
I think it's an increase in identifying and reporting. Elder abuse is way underreported nationally. It's the hidden crime that no one wants to talk about.
Why is it so hidden?
I think it's because people don't want to believe it happens to older adults, that people are very familiar with abuse and neglect when it comes to children. But when it comes to adults, they don't have an idea that it really happens to adults. And the victims of elder abuse are often reluctant to come forward because usually it's a family member or someone that they trust or know who is abusing them.
Hmm. Alice Page, advocates have worried that the pandemic caused underreporting of abuse, and we've heard from Doreen that is part of the problem. So what effect would you say that the pandemic had on elder abuse identifying and reporting?
Well, the big thing was that many older adults who are already isolated for a number of reasons became even more isolated during the pandemic. Many who were living in facilities were in facilities that were locked down because of the pandemic. Others who may have been living in the community, their adult children or their caregivers were reluctant to come to see them for fear of bringing the COVID virus to them, which we know would have more significant effects on older adults. So the isolation or the greater isolation of the pandemic provided an opportunity for abuse situations that were already in place to continue or to escalate, and for new it provided new opportunities where abuse wasn't happening because people realized that not so many eyes and ears were on our older adults during the pandemic. And our adult protective services workers in the counties reported to us that for the first months of the pandemic, Doreen described it as eerily quiet. They weren't getting reports, and now what we're finding is sort of that dam is broken, and the cases that are being reported and investigated for the last several months have been more severe, more complex. APS workers are finding older adults in worse condition, more have required hospitalizations. So the pandemic was sort of the perfect storm for elder abuse to either continue or to begin in various households.
That's Alice Page. She's an adult protective services and systems developer with the Wisconsin Bureau of Aging and Disability Resources. Also joined by Doreen Gretsch from the Wisconsin Bureau of Aging and Disability Resources. And they're here for your questions. Do you know what signs of elder abuse to look for? And what other questions would you have about elder abuse? How to identify it, and what happens when you report it? And Doreen Gretsch, let's go there for a moment. When there is a reported case of elder abuse, who is it that reports it?
Anybody can report elder abuse. However, primarily in Wisconsin, we receive a majority of our reports from healthcare providers. And I want the audience to know that anybody can report and anybody can remain anonymous when they report elder abuse. But what happens when a report is received is that it is received at the local level, at the county level, and it is either screened in or screened out according to statutes. If it is screened in, it is assigned to an adult protective services worker who makes contact with the victim and whoever is surrounded by that elder person.
And where would somebody go to report elder abuse, Doreen?
It can either be reported at the local level, or there is a toll-free hotline in Wisconsin. I can give you that number. It is 1-833-586-0107, or you can go directly to the website and you can report online, which is reportelderabusewisconsin.org.
reportelderabusewisconsin.org, or the hotline 833-586-0107. If you missed the number or website, hang tight, we'll give it out again because it's important. And as we heard, especially in as we are reopening from the pandemic and what we are finding in terms of elder abuse and how we can identify it as a community for our loved ones. Your questions, your stories at 1-800-642-1234. Our guests, Doreen Gretsch and Alice Page from the Wisconsin Bureau of Aging and Disability Resources. I'm Lee Rayburn, and this is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. In March, WBAY-TV in Green Bay searched thousands of records for the 175 assisted living and adult family homes in Brown County alone. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and they found 16 facilities that were cited for neglect or abuse in the past year and reports of injuries and deaths. And what are we going to do about that? What are the signs of elder abuse, and what effective steps can we take to keep our seniors safe? Your calls this morning at 1-800-642-1234. Your emails, ideas@WPR.org. And our guest this morning, Doreen Getch, is the Adult Protective Services Coordinator for the Wisconsin Bureau of Aging and Disability Resources. Alice Page is an Adult Protective Services and Systems Developer with the Wisconsin Bureau of Aging and Disability Resources. And Doreen, let me ask you, what does the data tell us about who's committing the elder abuse in Wisconsin?
Well, the data unfortunately shows what is a national trend and probably a worldly trend is that it's family members. It's last year in Wisconsin, 16% of the allegations were against adult sons, and 14% of the allegations were adult daughters. So normally it's usually someone close and trusted by the older adult.
And Alice, when it comes to criminal charges as a result of elder abuse, what's the process like and how often do we see it?
Well, that's unfortunate. It is often these cases are referred to law enforcement when there's criminal activity, but very few of these cases are prosecuted. One of the issues is that we have valuable limited resources, and so prosecutors tend to not focus on this. There's still a bit of some thinking that these are sort of family matters, that they're not issues that should be brought out into the open and looked at by law enforcement and prosecutors. Prosecutors, we do have some excellent elder abuse prosecutors in Wisconsin who are working not only on abuse, but financial exploitation, which is a huge problem in Wisconsin. It is the, after self-neglect, it is the second largest category of reports that we receive in Wisconsin for older adults. Older adults tend to be targeted for financial exploitation just because they tend to have more money, they've got pensions, Social Security, they may own a home, that kind of thing. So they tend to be the target of about 80% of our reports in Wisconsin.
80%. Doreen, Elliot from Ashland called, couldn't stay with us, but wanted to mention a Netflix film called I Care a Lot that touches on financial elder abuse by scammers. Are you familiar with the film? And can you put is there a dollar amount we can find on what this means, financial abuse for our elderly?
Well, in Wisconsin, for the first time ever last year, we asked counties to report specifically on financial exploitation, and they did. We had in Wisconsin a total of 1,700 reports just of financial exploitation, and the total amount that was reported that was lost in Wisconsin was $31.6 million. And we do know that that is a real underestimate because of the fact that these crimes and these allegations are underreported.
How are these criminals getting more than $31 million from our seniors?
It's amazing. It was just reported in the news, I believe, last week that a person in Sheboygan, one person alone, lost $19,000 to the grandparent scam.
I'm sorry, the grandparent scam?
Yes, this is one of the more common types of scams nationally, where a person calls an older adult and says, Grandma, I'm in jail. I can't tell anybody about it, but I need bail money and I need all sorts of money, and convinces this elder person that, in fact, this is their grandson or granddaughter. And unfortunately, the older adult goes to the bank, withdraws often large sums of cash, and sends them off to the scammers.
Of course, Grandma would do that for me. Doreen Getch is, and so it makes, I mean, at first the dollar amount is stunning, and then you find out the way they get into it, and it, you can understand why somebody might be willing to do that, no questions asked. Absolutely. Dorian Getch is the Adult Protective Services Coordinator for the Wisconsin Bureau of Aging and Disability Resources. Alice Page, also with the Wisconsin Bureau of Aging and Disability Resources. And tell me what to look for. Tell me how I can identify it. Give me some idea of how we can take steps in our own days to prevent elder abuse here. And I'd like to ask both of you. So, Alice, I'm going to ask you to go first.
Well, really, the most important thing is if you have an older adult that you're close to, a parent, a grandparent, an aunt, uncle, the best thing you can do is stay in contact with the person. Eyes and ears on a person is what prevents abuse. A lot of the abuse, and I use that word broadly, as Doreen mentioned earlier, is committed by family members. So having other family members with eyes and ears on the person. Same if you've got someone in a facility. Facility people tend to be more isolated. And so the more you can visit, the more you can have a presence in that facility, the better care your loved one is going to get and the less likely they are to be abused. So it's really watching, knowing the signs of elder abuse, working with your older adult loved one's bank. Banks can be a tremendous asset. They receive training on how to identify potential financial exploitation. Just knowing, as I said, the signs of all the types of abuse. If you notice, for example, that say your mother may sort of become withdrawn or act differently in the presence of another sibling or some other adult, that may be a sign that that person is abusing that person, because the person may appear withdrawn or agitated, those kinds of things. So there's signs of red flags of all the types of abuse. It would take too long to go through all those, right. But obviously if you see uncharacteristic bruising, broken bones, if you hear stories about how something happened, an injury happened, and it just doesn't add up, that's a red flag. So those are just some of the things that you can do, but more eyes and ears, the better your loved one is going to be.
And Dorian Getch, I'm sorry, we've got about 30 seconds, but is there more to add to that?
I would just say, and I always say this, if it doesn't feel right, if a situation makes your stomach hurt, it's probably not right. And you don't have to prove that something is going on. Report, and let the Adult Protective Services professionals investigate. Their whole job is to make that adult safe and figure out what is going on.
Dorian Getch, Alice Page, thank you both for joining us this morning.
You're most welcome.
Thank you.
Dorian and Alice are both with the Wisconsin Bureau of Aging and Disability Resources, and I'd like to reiterate those resources that are available to you and the words of our guests who say, report. If you suspect someone who is elderly is being abused in any way, the Wisconsin Elder Abuse Hotline will follow up. That number is 833-586-0107. That number again, 833-586-0107. We also have a link to the Report Elder Abuse Wisconsin website on our webpage, which you can find anytime at wpr.org/mornings. That's wpr.org/mornings. After the news, we take on the end of the war in Afghanistan for the hour. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.